Good day and welcome to the Miller Tabak hosted Domino's Group call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Stephen Anderson. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us for the Domino's Pizza Miller Tabak client conference call. We have on the line Mr. Michael Lawson, the CFO of Domino's. Jeff Lawrence is the Vice President and Finance and Treasurer at Domino's, as well as Chris Brandon, who's in Investor Relations. Domino's, as you know, is the global leader in pizza delivery, and without further ado, we're pleased to present Mr. Michael Lawson. Mr. Lawson, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. I'll start off with just a little bit of an intro on Domino's. I know many of you on the call are fairly familiar with our company and the results that we've put out, but let me give you a few reminders. First, we're a company with global strength. We have over 11,000 stores in over 75 markets around the world. Our international business has been growing rapidly over the last few years and is now actually larger in terms of retail sales and domestic and store count than our U.S. business. Our international business has enjoyed fantastic growth with over 21 years since we had a down quarter in the international business in terms of same-store sales growth. Much of our international business, or a meaningful piece, is actually owned by four different companies that are publicly held. One is based out of Australia and includes both the Japanese as well as some European businesses. One is based out of the UK, and that includes Ireland. They also have the rights to Germany and Switzerland. We have a business in Mexico that also has rights to Colombia and is acting as a master franchisee in Spain at this time. And then we have a business that's publicly held in India called Jubilant Foods, which has posted some great results as well. So if you've got an interest in what is going on in our world outside the U.S., there are plenty of places to look for information, and you may even have an interest in investing if you wanted to be outside of the U.S. and them directly. The U.S. business has been great for several years. Back at the end of 2009, we changed our product and in a very creative way relaunched our brand into the marketplace, and we have enjoyed meaningful growth since then. We now have approximately 25% of the delivered pizza market, and our market share in all pizza has been growing well. We have a strong franchisee base in the United States. Most franchisees in the U.S., almost all of them, in fact, grew up in the system, starting off working in stores, working up through being a store manager, and eventually making the decision to become a franchisee. Many of them are relatively small, owning four or five stores. We think that that's actually worked well for our system. Our biggest U.S. franchisee has about 135 stores. We've worked hard over the last few years to strengthen the franchisee base. At one time, we had close to 1,200 franchisees. We've worked that down, trying to weed out those people who just weren't quite as good as where the brand was going. After we fixed the pizza at the end of 2009, we've also worked to upgrade other items on the menu. The consumer perception of our food today is meaningfully different than it was 5 years ago. That's been supported not just by real changes to the food, but also with pretty compelling advertising. And we're doing other things to help people think differently about our company. We've been re-imaging our stores in the United States and in the foreign markets. By the end of 2016, we will have a large portion of the franchisee stores in the U.S. complete. And by the end of even 2015, we'll have most of our corporate stores redone here. Outside the U.S., where we're opening all new stores in a newer image, we're on somewhat the same track. And as you get into 2016, 2017, we'll be substantially re-imaged. In addition to the physical look of the stores, the other area that we've been working hard to put ourselves in the forefront to be a leader is in the technology side of our business, where we use technology and digital marketing to benefit our business as well as for online ordering. The big thing about online ordering is if you are a customer of ours and who's been ordering on a telephone and you start to use either your computer or your mobile device and access us through an app, we know you like that better. That is the big thing for us about technology. Customers like to order that way. They're more likely to order different items from us than just a pepperoni pizza. It works out well for us, and it works out well for them. Today, probably over 40% of our worldwide sales actually come in with orders off from a mobile device or off from a computer. When you think about the fact that many of our countries don't even have online ordering yet, you can certainly see that some of the markets are well over 40% of sales, and in the U.S. it's roughly 50% of sales. We also have some things that are relatively small today in the way of technology, but have the opportunity to grow, things like our voice ordering, our partnership with Ford Sync, Pebble Watches, and things like Twitter. And while these may be small today, everything starts small and has the opportunity to grow. But I think it shows more than anything our commitment that we want to be out in the forefront of technology because we think that's where the future is. As you turn to our franchisees and why we're having success in growing stores internationally and at a more moderate basis in the U.S., you know, one of the things we've always had is a good cost-efficient store model. It's relatively inexpensive to open a store compared to many other restaurants. Right now, to open a store in the U.S., most franchisees would be spending between $250,000 and $350,000. Against that, they've had good returns, and we've been very focused on helping our franchisees improve their profitability, with last year being well over $85,000 against their original investment on average, and for that was our best year in the history of the company. That's allowed us to continue to grow without a lot of investment. Our franchisees typically are investing in the stores. We do have almost 400 corporate stores in the U.S., but no stores outside the U.S., so most of our investment and capital goes into our distribution business, some into stores, but a large portion goes into the development of our technology, which is levered throughout our system. With that, I'll turn it over to Stephen and take a few questions.
Okay, well, so I think there are a few questions of my own before I turn it over to the audience, to the clients, rather. Just wanted to talk about some of the trends that have been going on in the industry. You saw what happened with this burger industry. We got a big spike in January. Sales trends just in general have been flattening out, but what are your insights on the industry trends since the beginning of the year? And do you think it's more gasoline prices? Is it employment trends? Or what do you think is the most important indicator you look at?
Well, for one, since we're right at the end of our second quarter, I really can't comment on trends since the end of the first quarter. But I can tell you, you know, both in the fourth quarter of last year and first quarter of this year, you know, we clearly were enjoying very strong sales. As we posted double-digit sales comps, our take on the market on that time was that the market was a little bit better than it had been. It's probably growing a little bit, not necessarily gas prices. I don't think that makes a lot of difference. But what we think makes the most difference in terms of economic indicators is employment. We know from when we see not just the U.S. market but others, when we see unemployment go up, that's not necessarily good for us, and unemployment going down is. And the reason is, if you're sitting at home collecting unemployment, you certainly don't need a delivered pizza. I mean, you've got time to make and cook and save a little bit of money. But because pizza is a really good value, if you've got a job and you're stretched for time, you know, there's lots of different ways, whether it be through delivery for large for families or through carryout, you know, to access our product, and we think that's one of the bigger indicators. Our take was that the industry overall is up a little bit, but a little bit is still 1 or 2 or 3 points, and there aren't real accurate numbers on that. You know, there was a point in time 2, 3, 4 years ago when we felt like the market was pretty flat. We think it's a little bit positive, but we think more than anything, you know, there's some share movement going on. And share movement comes from, you know, Pizza Hut, who clearly we've been doing a little better than them the last few months. But we also think that what we're doing in technology and what we've done to build our brand is also helping to continue to take some business away from some of the smaller regional chains and some of the mom and pops.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at a global basis, are there any particular markets outside the U.S. where you're seeing strength and any markets are seeing weakness?
No. As far as our sizable countries, Last year we were talking a little bit about the fact that India had hit a little bump in the road, and they've been one of our best performing markets. And when they released, you know, they're back in positive territory on their same store sales growth while also having, you know, very rapid store growth, including a lot of splits in territory, which does have a tendency to bring your same store sales growth down a little bit. So they're back on track, and other than that, you know, most of the big markets continue to do well. And as you know, I mean, we're spread geographically. We've got a real good presence and good strength throughout Asia, throughout Europe, throughout South America, as well as Canada.
I saw the press release this morning about your first store in Portugal, so good luck to you there.
Thank you.
So regarding the current competitive landscape, do you think the pressure to discount heavily has abated much at all? You know, now with things that, you know, the industry at least looks like it's beginning to grow again, but do you still feel that need to, your peers feel the need to discount aggressively?
Well, I think the type of customer that most QSR pizza appeals to is always going to be somewhat value conscious, and our price points reflect that. But I think that if you look at the success we enjoyed last year in the first quarter of this year, while most of their growth came out of order count growth, and the fact is we also had a little bit of ticket growth. So we didn't get it by increased discounting. I think you have to be very selective and very careful about how much price you take and where you take it. But that's what we've been doing. A little harder for us to say exactly what our competitors do with price, because you can look at a menu price in the pizza business, but that doesn't mean much. In the end, it's what's the promoted price or the discount price, and that's a lot harder to track. But we know what we've been doing, and that is trying to maintain a good, healthy business for us and our franchisees, and we have not really been that aggressive on the pricing.
The $5.99 price point, you know, pick two, I mean, that's still, very relevant, still very powerful. But, I mean, sometimes I think in a commodity cost environment like this, you probably can have some leeway there, but I think it's a point in time where you feel like you'll maybe need to, say, if, cheese starts to spike back up again.
Well, this year, commodity prices, end of my first quarter call, a couple of months ago, I said we're actually projecting that the market basket of our products used would be down 3-6% versus last year, so it gives you a little bit of room. The other piece about pricing is one of, food cost is just one part of what the cost to run in a store are. And if you're growing your order counts and you're getting more leverage out of your rent, your utilities, more efficiency out of your labor, now, sometimes you can afford to have price points that look like they're a little bit lower, but they still are very good at generating profits. And as we said, our franchisees have done well. We started with a price point of $5.99, two at $5.99, not just one, because one would be a little hard for kind of delivery business. But we started that when we did our relaunch of our brand back at the end of 2009, and we've been able to maintain that price point. And, as I say, the fact that our franchisees are doing well with it, if they weren't, we'd have more pressure. But when the franchisees will look at the results for last year and say it's the best year they ever had, as you can imagine, I mean, they're looking beyond just the food costs and saying, this is working for me. So I think we have a little bit of room. Certainly could happen on some items. Certainly could happen at some point in time when you've got to change it. I don't think we want to get totally known for having certain price points we can never move away from. There was a chain that got a little carried away with that in the past, and I think they struggled when they had problems, which I think is your point. But I think so far for us it's worked out, and I think if we had to, we could move it. But we're in good shape right now.
Okay. I do have a question from our participants about China. And I wanted to see if there's been any movement there. I mean, it's still a very early stage there, but what are your thoughts about development at this point?
We have a presence in both Beijing and Shanghai. And, while it may be early stage in terms of the scale of our business, unfortunately, it's not early stage in terms of our presence in China. We have been there a long time. We have not had a great deal of success. And when I say a long time, I mean, I go back to 1997, I think, was when the first door was opened. And the good part is that more and more we are seeing that the market in China is becoming much more acceptive of pizza and of delivery. And we did some things in China trying to find a way to make our brand work when we knew that the market wasn't really ready for us. The good part is right now some of the stores that are much more like the traditional Domino's, they may have a little more seating but a lot more like their traditional stores, are starting to have more success, and that's a positive. And we're also seeing that with Pizza Hut and their delivery business. You know, the things that we look for are certainly happening. I think everybody has always felt compelled to be in China, even if it wasn't quite ready for us. But it's certainly getting a lot closer than it was before. But we have a relatively small business. We're at 60, 70 stores, 70, 80 stores. It's not a big number, but we're learning, and you know, there's opportunity there.
Okay. With regard to the fast casual pizza category, names like Blaze and Pizza Rev, I mean, what would you say, you know, is your primary competitive advantage over those new chains?
Well, they have some advantages versus us. Most of them are making a type of product that can be cooked faster. The good part about faster cooking is obviously your customer doesn't have to wait long, and at a lunch business, that's nice. The bad part about a lot of those products is they do not deliver well, and they're not nearly as good for off-premise. They just don't hold the heat as well. So there is a reason our product is done the way it is, and that is because we're targeted a certain piece of the pizza market. But we see some of the things that they are doing that, you know, can conceivably cause competitive advantage for them or create competitive advantage. They've opened up their stores so that the food is more visible. Well, it happens, we're not opening up our stores because of fast casual, but we're reading the same market research they are as to what consumers want, and we're trying to do the same thing as we do our reimages. So while we're not trying to worry about having to go head-to-head with them, we're certainly not trying to leave, you know, areas that we know are of concern to our customers wide open to them. And I think we're in pretty good shape for being a delivery carryout business.
And this has been mentioned a lot in recent in the press about product and menu ingredient transparency. Is this something that you see the need to do at this time?
I absolutely think we should be. Back in October, I got involved in supply chain on what is for what has been a fairly extended period now, and I got involved, you know, much closer to the food side than I had been before because of the role I took on. And I don't think it's necessarily just because of what's happened in the last couple of months. I mean, to me, it was in our best interest to look at the way we're sourcing product and the way we're producing our dough and everything else, and where we can, you know, if there's opportunities to take out something that might sound like an additive that doesn't have to be there, it's in our best interest to do so. So we've been doing some of that work. I'm not sure we're going to talk about it or address it the same way some people have, but it's the right thing to do, so why wouldn't you?
Okay. Now, I mean, this is going back a little bit on the pizza theater renovations underway. And now as you're sort of like well into the renovations, I mean, what kind of sales list specifically are you seeing for the most recent round of renovations, and is this consistent with what you've been looking at in past periods?
We're continuing to see that if you go out and pick one store and you look at what's going on there, you are looking at low single-digit improvement in same-store sales versus the control. On its own, a reimage doesn't get you a huge amount, in part because the number of carryout customers we have going into the store per week is not that high, so it's a little harder for it to be seen. It takes time. But we really do believed when we went into this reimaging program that the real key is what does this do over time for the brand. And we also felt like we were getting to a point where we just flat out had to get better and clean up the stores and make them look different and better, or we ran the risk that they really got so run down that we would see big jumps in sales because they were in bad shape. But we weren't there yet, but we needed to do something. So we're getting kind of what we expected. And as you look at the pizza industry and you look at other companies that have done this in the U.S., not just in the U.S., but in foreign markets, it has not been uncommon that the returns or increases in same-store sales from reimages have been lower than you often see if you're in the hamburger business, and it's got a lot to do with the number of customers coming in the stores. But we still feel really good about it, and we do think it may be part of what's contributing to, you know, the overall growth in our sales. And as more and more markets, you know, get to a point where half or more of the stores are done, hopefully that's one of the things that it takes to continue to get people to think positively about our brand.
I just have one follow-up about that. I know Papa John's for years has been doing they had their, you know, loyalty points, the Papa points, and you go online, you order pizza, you get additional points to order free pizza. I mean, do you see the need to do something similar, like some, like not just pizza competitors, but like other competitors in the industry doing something on loyalty?
Loyalty has always been an interesting question because there's more than one reason to do it. One is to get data. And right now, you know, we have ways that you can go in, you set up an account, we can track you better, and we love having all that data because it makes it easier and we become better at marketing directly to you. And I'm sure it's one of the reasons that in many different, you know, parts of the QSR business, you know, the different companies have tried to have the loyalty programs because they're looking for data, and it's something that we certainly consider is, you know, how much more would we get with a loyalty program? And the other is just flat out, what does it do for your consumer behavior? Our marketing department has looked in and will continue to look at every different opportunity out there, and this is definitely one that they'll continue to spend time on.
Okay. I just want to open this up to any questions from our participants.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. And again, that is star 1 to ask a question.
Okay. You know, maybe I just want to do a follow-up on a couple of questions I have on technology. Just to go forward, you mentioned, you know, this, you get, right now you have 50% of sales in the U.S. from the online and mobile channels, and, you know, in some markets around the world, probably it's higher than that right now. And you've been seeing this in recent years, about 5% per year acceleration. With, you know, some of the new technologies that are out there, have you seen any kind of acceleration of this adoption rate? Like, is it going any faster, do you feel?
No, we haven't really seen it change a whole lot. We don't know how high it can go. We certainly don't think that the consumer is ready for it to go to 100% yet. What we have seen is that the ordering online off computers continues to be a very meaningful piece, but the areas that have been growing faster are, you know, not surprisingly, off mobile devices. But, you know, growing in that 4 to 5% a year range has been going on now for several years, and it was about the same last year.
Okay. And this is what I wanted to ask you. You just see the need, I mean, you gave some guidance on accelerating SG&A spending. Do you need to increase that?
Maybe it's best if I give a little background. This year, we gave a range for what we expect our SG&A to come in at versus last year, and that is a higher number. A couple things I would point to. One is we have continued to spend more on e-commerce, both on development as well as ongoing support. We also have more depreciation on some of the capital that we've put into e-commerce. We also spend, in addition to e-com, in the areas of technology and our point-of-sale system that's used in all the domestic stores as well as over half the international stores. Important to note that against some of these increases in spend, we do charge a transaction fee in the U.S. and in the foreign markets to help recover that cost. And the goal over time is you know, to make this meaningful, not necessarily to add to the profit stream in the U.S., but at least to recover everything that we're out of pocket on. And right now that means we're booking revenue, you know, at over $1 million a month to help offset that. I wish I could just net it so I could say my SG&A is not up, but that's part of where it goes. In addition to increases in spending on e-com, We have continued to invest in people that are supporting the growth of our international business and some in marketing. So we've been explaining to, investors that, yes, our SG&A is up. It's not quite as bad as it sounds when you think of the fact that we're a franchisor and some of our SG&A isn't back office accountants who I have the same number of accountants I had 5 years ago when I became CFO, even though we're a lot bigger. But some of the things that kind of fit into that category are really about developing the business, particularly on that e-com line.
Okay. I wanted to go a little more on your social strategy. I saw you the new emoji-based ordering. I mean, and that was something else e-com that was common. Tell me maybe a little more what you're doing in terms of social that maybe sets you apart from the rest of the of your competitors.
I think if you look at the group that we've got running digital, their goal is to pursue anything that they think makes sense for us right now or is likely to be something that we should be on the front end of because it could become bigger later. And in some cases, it flat out is, it may not be big right now, but it gives us something that is innovative and for our customers. We have found that some of our advertising, which doesn't talk about new food product, but does talk about innovation, is just as effective for us as new food, which is disruptive to the system sometimes. So if you take something like Dom, which is our voice ordering, we're not getting a huge number of orders using voice, but the ability to take that very creative work, something that was front edge, turn that into an advertisement, talk about what it means to us to be on the front end and just part of our brand development, worked very, very well for us. And so some of what you see is as much about, innovation, trying to be innovative and knowing that, it may not mean immediate orders off from that device or that approach, but that could be where the market goes over time. And if not, we still get some side benefits out of it. Because consumers like innovation. We have to have something real to talk about, and that's what they like.
Okay. I just want to open up for some additional questions. I know a couple of people have joined us.
Once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question on today's call.
Okay. Just want to get a little bit of follow-up on the commodity costs. I know earlier on the call, you said you're still projecting about a 3-6% decline year over year. And as you know, I think the big story in the commodity universe has been the avian flu outbreak. And I think all the ones that have heavy exposure to eggs, a little bit of a panic right now. But obviously, you don't have any egg-specific products, but do you have any ancillary exposure to some of the oils or some of the mayonnaise or anything like that?
Anything there would be very minor. And, hopefully avian flu, because of the fact that typically goes away as you get into warmer months, hopefully that will be very short-lived for those companies that do have a problem. I mean, we obviously do have buy a lot of chicken, and we buy chicken wings. Chicken wing prices are up from where they were a year ago. And I don't really see a lot of reason to think that that's going to come back down. But we've seen, since the end of Q1, we've seen a spike in cheese prices. We've seen a spike in wing prices. We expected some spike in cheese, so that was factored in. And even the changes in wings aren't enough to, as I say, that there's a lot of movement there. But we're in pretty good shape. I'm not worried about the eggs, though. That's a very, very, very small piece of anything we would do.
As you mentioned the cheese, do you see this more of a weather impact or a demand impact, and what do you think is driving that?
Well, cheese has spiked up in the 170s for the spot, and that is much closer to what the longer-term average has been. So, last year we didn't really understand all the factors that pushed it up to 240. Sometimes it's a little harder to see why they get all the way down in the 150s and stay there. 170s has certainly been more of an average price, and there's a little bit of seasonality on cheese as well, but While it's spiked up, it certainly is not out of range of where the norms are.
Yeah, not what it was a year ago at the time. We were in the, you know, well above $2. I think there was some additional transportation issues, I remember last year with the cheese prices and dairy in general.
We certainly were at a high point then. Exports were certainly running high. Supply certainly was, you know, last year being the 2013-2014 winter, milk supplies were hurt a little bit by really abnormally cold temperatures. There were a lot of little factors that were put out there as possible reasons. All we know is we were paying record high prices, and now we're back down to what are more normal prices.
Another cost center being labor costs. I mean, that's want to get your current thoughts on what's been going on. You know, some of the states and localities. You know, Los Angeles is just passing a minimum wage law that gets up to $15 by 2020. And just want to get your overall thoughts. Do you think it's being driven more by what the franchise is seeing in individual markets, or is it more by by legislative fiat?
I think that very much depends on the market. I mean, if you're in Seattle, you certainly, franchisees have to comply with whatever the law is there. Outside of that, it's certainly franchisees are going to adapt to what the market prices are to get their employees. And, it can be difficult when you've got real shocks and big changes, but they're going to find a way to adapt as long as if the playing field is level, they'll adapt to it. So.
Mm-hmm. I mean, can you put a percentage in terms of quantify what kind of labor costs increases you're seeing on a year-over-year basis?
Not really. I mean, you've got some that I'm sure the rate's up, but you're also seeing, as you can, with you look at the first quarter where the volumes were up so much, and if you're a franchisee, you're getting leverage off it. So you've got a lot of different factors at play. Our corporate stores, we had really high volumes in the first quarter, and as you saw the results in the first quarter, we had real good earnings results, and so there's just a lot of variables there, and you work within the business circumstances that you're in.
Okay, I didn't even mention about the company-owned stores, and I know it's in the last call or two, and actually I saw there's a new one near me, some of the company-owned stores in certain markets, and in some of these other markets like New York City where the labor costs are significantly higher than other parts of the country. I mean, have you modeled that in terms of your what you're looking at for the full year, the fact that, in these new company-owned stores, you're going to have a higher labor cost?
Well, we certainly take into account whenever we look at building a new store, what the environment is that we're in, whether it be high rents like New York or labor or whatever. But that's all taken account on an individual store basis. Each year we go through with our corporate stores and we look at minimum wage increases state by state. While some of these big numbers are getting play in the press at the $15 numbers or whatever, the fact is many states have an increase in the minimum wage each year or an indexing or whatever, and we deal with that. We don't have an intention to greatly increase the number of corporate stores. We've been building a few. We've also been selling a few, and we bought a couple. But we've been in that 380 to 400 number, and I don't think it's going to be unduly difficult for us to, with that number of stores, to deal with any changes that come at us.
Okay. Now, I have a question about your balance sheet and any potential refinancing. As you know, certainly you're approaching the low end of your recent range. I think it's about 4 to 5 or so on the long-term debt EBITDA range. Just wanted to get your thoughts about potentially even adding leverage to your balance sheet, particularly the peers of the Fed about to embark on rate hiking. How comfortable you feel about your leverage?
I'm not uncomfortable with where we're at. We have said we'd like to be between, 3 times EBITDA and 6 times EBITDA. We're certainly getting down in below the midpoint of that range, but that's okay for a period of time. we've certainly kept a close eye on the market. We've seen Dunkin' and Wendy's follow our approach of using asset-backed securities, you know, a whole business securitization, you know, to refinance their companies. We're not in a situation where we could refinance because of the call premiums that are out there. In October, we do have the opportunity to call a third of the debt and could at par and could do so. And if we did, we could also, if we chose to, tack on some additional debt. It's something that we are would certainly have considered and would continue to consider. But we're not uncomfortable with where we are. We don't feel like there's a compelling reason that says that's the only choice, and we'll continue to assess it and also assess doing something versus maintaining a little flexibility. So we're not in a bad situation right now.
Now, you mentioned that you're not being able to refinance. I mean, let me get more, a little more specific on that. I mean, you're not being able to refinance some of the floating rate debt into fixed, you know, maybe to lock in certain rates. You know, Duncan had done that very recently, and you know, they're maybe paying a little bit more on interest, but something that they can lock in for some time. Is that an option that's available to you?
Actually, all of if you're in asset-backed securities like we are, unlike the traditional bank financing, it is fixed from the beginning. So the securities that they went to are now fixed. Ours are fixed, but at the time we went to market, it was, you know, we were able to get a situation where we could call a third of it 3 years in advance of maturity, 4.5, and the rest of it was callable at par 18 months prior to maturity. They also have situations where they can't call any of that fixed rate debt for periods of time. So it isn't a matter of being able to swap it out. It's that they had a different type of security. They've gone to ABS. They're going to deal with some of the same challenges. We felt it was the right thing to do when we did this. We got, you know, the deal that was available at the time. But the penalties, you know, that you pay if you try to get out of those deals early are fairly significant. I mean, they're so big right now, it's not even worthy of consideration. So
if you were to refinance, do it another day, I mean, have the penalties in this case, would they be smaller, just theoretically speaking?
If we, say it again, please.
If you were to refinance the debt, you know, again, if you were to enter the market again, would you encounter the same penalties?
Oh, the market today is better than when we refinanced 3 years ago. So the answer would be yes, we still have penalties, but would we probably be able to negotiate and get better terms than we were able to get 3 years ago? The answer is today specifically, yes, probably.
Okay.
One of the challenges with that, with the asset-backed security market, is that it is a relatively thin market compared to traditional bank financing. So when the market is good, it's really good, and when the market's really bad, I mean, in 2009, it basically disappeared. So there are a number of considerations that go into, you know, the timing and what you want to lock yourself into. We felt very good about what we locked ourselves into 3 years ago. It's worked out well for us, but would it look better today? The answer is yes.
I just want to see if there are any follow-up questions.
Once again, that is star one to ask a question.
Okay, and I'm not seeing, I think, I don't see anything at this time. I just wanted to ask Michael, if there are any closing remarks.
I'd just like to say I appreciate everybody's interest in us and the fact that many of the people on your call have been supporters either today or in previous times. We appreciate that. And we're going to do our best to make sure that if you choose to be one of our investors, we're going to do our best to try to continue to reward you. That's all I can say. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's presentation. We thank you for your participation.